I apologize for my tardiness, but I have Wednesday morning meetings in the Senate President's office, and sometimes they run a little over. An announcement on April 7th, which is next Monday. James Matheson of Mercer and two colleagues from AZ are presenting to the House Audit Committee on tax reports, which is from the attachment in here, which is from House Bill 2519 last session. There will be a kind of discussant panel made up of FCHP folks as well. Since these guys are flying in and there is a lot of content, the meeting will be extended from 5 till 6. So actually from 3 to 6 rather than 3 to 5. And if you want committee members, if you plan on attending, get a hold of Rick Bacobian and you can get the summary if you haven't got it already. And actually, just hanging up the first 8 pages, because it's a 55-page summary. But I think it's going to give us a little higher level of detail in the stuff we've been discussing in audit. So just to let you know.
What day again?
That's next Monday. But audit, and a normal audit time, except we're extending till 6 to accommodate the folks that are coming from a long way to talk to us. So, excuse me. With that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2642. Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. House Bill 2642 is exempting. We had a public hearing on the bill in the middle of March, March 14th. As you recall, this was the bill that we heard testimony requesting that we remove the exemption status or the 6-year sunset date for the emergency services for requiring insurance coverage of emergency services. It also clarifies the definition of emergency medical condition, and it declares an emergency. We do have the -1 amendments, and the amendments do just that. Actually, it just extends the sunset to October 4th, 2009, instead of removing the sunset completely.
Excuse me. Any discussion? The chair would entertain a motion on the -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move -1 amendments to House Bill 2642.
Representative Tomei moves -1 amendment to House Bill 2642. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2642 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2642 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? No. Clerk, call the roll. Excused.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye. House, do you want to?
Sure.
Okay. Representative Tomei moves that House Bill 2642 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there? She did. It was. She can speak in shorter phrases than I can. It's amazing. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And House Bill 2642, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2642 and open a work session on House Bill 2191. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2191, we heard, received public testimony on February 10th, and at that time we had some requests for amendment languages. This, the bill is including the Employment Department in the development of voluntary statewide early childhood system. It adds the director of the Employment Department or, at the governor's direction, chairperson of the Commission for Child Care to the State Commission on Children and Family. It involves the local child care resource and referral agencies in work and local commissions on children and families. It expands the definition of child for the purposes of certifying and registering child care facilities to include certain special needs children under 18 years of age, and it excludes certain facilities and parent cooperatives from the requirement for child care facilities. The amendments further clarify disabilities and special needs. It further clarifies, adds some language that relates to the parent cooperatives. It also clarifies certification and registration requirements, and it does add an emergency clause. You should have the dash twos as well as the hand and gross version of the bill. And Donna.
Donna, you want to come up too? You don't have to, but if you'd like to. Good morning. Anything to add, or are you just here to end?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here just to provide technical assistance or answer questions.
Okay, but you would like to, you want to say anything, or?
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Donna Middleton. I'm the Director of the Commission on Children and Families. I testified once before on this piece of legislation and just want to reiterate the fact that whether the legislation requires that we have a working relationship with the Commission on Child Care or Child Care Division, we will do so anyway, that we are continuing to do so, and that it would make very little difference at this particular time, one way or the other, whether this was in statute or not, because I think we're going to be doing it anyway, because that's the way we're working together. So.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Tomei.
So this adds one more person to the commission, the state commission. How does that affect the state commission at all?
Representative Tomei, we have 16 members as it is. That's a lot of folk, and this would add a 17th. As we're all aware, resources are scarce, but we do currently have folks on the State Commission that have early childhood background and are very supportive of child care, and we also have child care block grant dollars that we support. So additional person, I think, is not an issue. Other than the fact that it is, one more person to support on the State Commission.
I'm going to follow up since he's. So when you say support, what do you mean, Donna?
Representative Tomei, there is resources for state commissioners to travel, to support staff work, to do subcommittee work, and all of those kinds of things. So each additional person requires some additional staff work and support to make it a good process.
I see.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I served on the commission, the Child Care Commission, over the interim, and this is something that we as a commission felt was really important. Child care has not gotten the attention, especially from the legislature, that it should, and this was one way in which we can really make a statement that child care is really important and they really need to be mentioned in statute.
Mm-hmm. So any other questions? Thank you very much. The position of the chair on this is basically what Representative Mona Sanderson said is, even though this may be happening now, I think codifying it makes it very clear and explicit, and I think it's appropriate thing for this legislative body to do. So if there's no further questions, I would entertain a motion on the dash two amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move dash two amendment to House Bill 2191.
Representative Tomei moves the dash two amendment to House Bill 2191. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, dash two amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2191 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I'm assuming that
yes,
it would not go back to Ways and Means, even though there's a new cost to the commission.
The new cost would be negligible, since how if indeed it is the director of the employment department that is added, it would be within his scope of activities, and it shouldn't add any additional cost to him to do this.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Mona or Tomei, has moved the House Bill 2191 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Excused.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Dalto.
Aye.
Representative Montanus.
Aye.
Representative
Tomei. Aye.
Representative Wesley.
Excused. Aye.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2191 to the consent agenda.
Okay. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2191 be placed on the consent calendar. Objections?
Well, yeah, because I want to make a statement about child care.
Okay. Good enough. Okay. House Bill 2191, having received the constitutionally required majority, is declared passed. Representative Mona Sanderson will carry. And she wanted to make the statement, so what better way than carrying? And we will close the work session on House Bill 2191. Open a work session on House Bill 2374. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2374, as you recall, we had received public testimony on March 14th. This is requiring reimbursement to certain rural health clinics for prescription and dispensing of prescription drugs. At that time, there was some discussion on some amendments. You have before you the Dash 4 amendments, which
replace all the other dashes.
Right. So the one that all parties involved have reviewed and have agreed upon are the Dash 4s. You should also have with your materials, I believe, a letter of support from the Department of Consumer and Business Services Insurance Division on the Dash 4s.
Yes, and I received that in my office yesterday, so I'm assuming everybody else did also.
Okay.
So.
And the Dash 4 amendment modifies or changes the definition of acute to urgent. It specifies several other prescription dispensing conditions, and it also specifies that the drug benefit provisions be consistent with the drug policy of the plans.
Okay. Is there any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember which person was... had some concerns. I think Peggy.
But Peggy's okay with the fours. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So I mean, we got it. We got into some lawyer type things on this, but I think at the end of the day, we have general agreement. So. Yeah.
Is Jim Edge going to be testifying this evening?
My assumption at this point is that since everybody's agreed to it, that nobody is feeling compelled to do anything.
Great.
So,
I move we accept the House 4 amendment, or the Dash 4 amendment.
Representative Barker moves the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2374. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 4 amendment is adopted.
I'll move House Bill 2374 to the floor on the consent agenda.
Well, you can move it to the floor with a due pass. Okay.
Okay.
It's, you know, we can't cut out steps. It's just not okay. Representative Barker moves House Bill 2374 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Excused.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Dalton.
Aye.
Representative Montanus.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused. Aye. Now, do you want to make that motion?
Okay. I'd like to move this bill to the consent calendar. Consent agenda.
Consent agenda. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. House Bill 2374, as amended, having received the required majority, is declared passed and placed on the consent calendar. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2374. You guys are being incredibly cooperative today. I don't really like this. I know. There's a storm brewing somewhere. Oh, Lordy. I'm going to open a public hearing on HCR 7. Representative Merkley. Your timing is impeccable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Representative Jeff Merkley from East Portland, and thank you for the opportunity to come and testify on HCR 7. Jerry Bieberle was a hero for the community of the poor and the underprivileged. He often noted that the purpose of his life took shape during his work as an advance man for Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy thought and talked a lot about the poor and the obligation of society to give every American the opportunity to have a stake in the community and a part of the American dream. The ideals that were part of that campaign left a deep imprint on Jerry. Working to further the ideals presented in that campaign became Jerry's life mission, and in due course he became an enormously effective advocate for Oregon's poorest citizens. Jerry came to Oregon in the mid-1970s and served about 10 years as deputy director and then director of the Community Service Agency, Oregon's anti-poverty office. Jerry viewed his constituency as the impoverished, and he sought to serve those constituents effectively by strengthening the Community Action Projects, or CAPs, through which the state provided direct services to the poor. He was, however, aware of the shortcomings of working through a bureaucracy, and in the mid-1980s, he left his office to influence Oregon's programs for the poor as a lobbyist, and he served this state in that capacity until his death. I want to share with you a few thoughts on Jerry's style. He strived to operate with dignity and with respect for his colleagues. He presented himself elegantly and eloquently, and he was a professional in every good sense of the word. He combined enormous expectations with political pragmatism. He knew, and his friends knew, that most of the folks in Salem fell short of his expectations a good share of the time. He was disappointed, for example, that Oregon's governors failed to invest significant political capital in the cause of serving the poor. This was not a criticism of any one governor, but rather a universal criticism, leading him to refer to the governor's office, regardless of who occupied it, as the black hole in the middle of the building. This was vintage Jerry calling upon our highest leaders to do more, to not forget in the whirl of competing interests that there is a great group of salt-of-the-earth Oregonians struggling to get their feet under them, and that we can and should do more to make it possible for them to succeed. And Jerry was not always impressed by the legislature either. In the spring of 2001, he spoke at a rally organized by Bob Castagna, and Bob dedicated this rally titled Campaign for Fairness in Jerry's honor. Jerry counseled the assembled crowd to not let legislators off the hook when advocating for Oregon citizens working to climb the first rung on the economic and social ladder. He relayed to the crowd that when he talked to legislators about important programs, legislators would often respond by saying, "Jerry, we've got some tough decisions to make." And this is code, of course, for, "I'm sorry, but we're not going to be able to provide the resources for which you are asking." And Jerry's response to this lament was, "So what? I make tough decisions every day." This, too, was vintage Jerry, cutting to the core of the issue. It frustrated him that we could spend $100 million on a tax deduction, but would moan and groan about resources when considering a $12 million budget for affordable housing. He was involved in many key activities in this state, including moving the Community Service Agency into the Housing Department, establishing the 1991 Housing Trust Fund, founding the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I'll leave it to others to say more details about that. But what I'd like to say is that in 1999, when I came to the legislature, he was one of the first lobbyists I met who spoke about these core issues of creating a better society. As most of you know, Jerry had been fighting cancer for about a year when he died. He went into the 1991 legislative session knowing that he was in a tough battle for his life, but he was optimistic. He said, if asked, that the cancer might slow him down, but he planned to get up each day and do all he could. And some of us may think, why did he work so hard in these final months of his life? Why not retreat to the sunshine, or at least reserve energy to fight the cancer? And the answer was, I think, that Jerry was a man who understood his calling. It's not often you meet a person with a clear vision of why he or she is placed on this earth and has complete dedication to that mission, but Jerry was that type of person. And so he kept coming down here to the legislature despite his illness. The cancer attacked his hip and was making it hard for him to walk, but he kept working. And I think all of you may remember him walking across the balcony as we sat down on the floor, first with a limp and then with a cane and then with more and more effort. The treatment he hoped would send cancer into remission didn't work, and he kept working. And the cancer made it unsafe for him to drive, but he kept working. His efforts were a display of exceptional character. He got up and made the best of every day and directed whatever energy he had toward his mission of helping the poor. I would like to thank you for considering this resolution for this extraordinary man. It's been a privilege for me to serve in this legislature while he was an advocate here for poor Oregonians. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you. Representative, I'm assuming that you would like to carry this.
I would appreciate the chance to do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've got a fair list of folks here, but I'm going to take the privilege of the chair just for a moment here. We've been under some attack in the paper about doing resolutions, and in spite of that, I'm doing this resolution because I think this is important and it's not a waste of money. Jerry was a friend. And he is an honorable man. I actually fought to get this resolution in my committee because I wanted the honor of sending it to the floor out of this committee. And when my current LA was my committee administrator and was trying to learn the ropes, Jerry took her under his wing and just taught her so much stuff. And that's just the type of person he was. And I think if we let the press or anybody else divert us from honoring honorable people, we're not doing our job. And so let the Oregonians say whatever the hell they want about us doing this. This is a just and appropriate thing to do. So I'm going to stop because I'm a Republican. I'm not supposed to get emotional. I came close. Bonnie Davidson and Ellen Lowe. You're going to kind of tag team folks here. Don't see anybody signed up against this, so that's good.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Bonnie Davidson, and I serve as the Executive Director for Community Action Directors of Oregon. CATO is comprised of 18 community action agencies serving 34 Oregon counties. Our mission is to alleviate the causes and conditions of poverty in Oregon, and we act as the delivery system for federal anti-poverty programs. I am honored to be here today speaking on behalf of HCR 7, which honors our dear friend and colleague, Jerry Beberly. Jerry worked with and for Community Action in Oregon for almost 20 years, tirelessly addressing the issue of poverty. He cared deeply about those without a voice, about social justice, and about the vulnerable. Jerry's passion, his commitment, and his drive to work for and deliver resources to low-income Oregonians will not soon be matched. Let me tell you a little bit about him. On a chilly April night in 1987, Jerry, wearing his cute little beanie cap, joined CATO President John Mullen and another 30 homeless Oregonians and their advocates on the steps of this very building. They spent the long, cold night huddled in their sleeping bags, working to draw attention to the plight of the homeless in Oregon. They were even joined for a while by Secretary of State Barbara Roberts and Senator Frank Roberts. Later, Jerry would use this experience as a strong example of how quickly homelessness becomes the great equalizer. After only one night on the streets, both John and Jerry swore you couldn't tell the advocates from those forced to endure long-term homelessness. The cold, the lack of showers and clean clothes, sleeping on the ground, the hunger, all worked their way into Jerry's spirit and became part of his drive to succeed in his own personal war against poverty. To identify Jerry Bieberle as a special human being does not go far enough. You may have known Jerry. You may have been lucky enough to work with him. You may have called him hero, mentor, poverty warrior, and friend. Upon hearing that he only had a year left to live, Jerry made the decision to pack every moment of his last year with life, with work, with fighting poverty. In his final months, he needed to use a cane, then a walker, to get around the building. A tank of oxygen became his constant companion, yet none of this stopped Jerry. He worked the halls of the Capitol throughout the 2001 session, fighting, railing against the injustices of poverty until the end. I once asked Jerry why he chose to end his life like this, working so hard, struggling for small victories when he could be on a beach in sunny Mexico. Jerry simply replied, "My work isn't done. I know we will not end poverty in my lifetime, and I regret that. But I will keep working to that goal until the day that I die." Jerry died in August of 2001 and kept his pledge as a poverty warrior. His spirit lives on, and it is left to us to fulfill Jerry's dream of ending poverty. His list of accomplishments stuns us. How could one human being do so very much? And while Jerry died without realizing the creation of his final dream for low-income Oregonians, that of a comprehensive poverty commission, Cato is working to make that dream a reality with House Bill 3573, the creation of the Oregon Opportunity Commission. Jerry knew that poverty as a concept and as a reality affects all of us. He believed that ending or even reducing poverty would provide untold benefits to our society and ultimately reduce human pain and tragedy. Months before his death, I asked Jerry how it was possible for him to have done so much for so many. He thought for a moment, smiled, and answered, I'm nobody special. I'm just doing my part, the same as everybody else." Members of the committee, I would respectfully disagree with Mr. Jerry Bieberle. He was someone special, very special in the halls of this building, very special to all the organizations he worked with, and most of all, very special to the low-income and vulnerable people of this state. I can think of no Oregonian more deserving of a memorial resolution than Gerald J. Jerry Bieberle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think many of you know that Jerry and I were first friends and then partners. He was my mentor. He was my guide. He was probably someone who brought more dignity to the occupation of lobbyist than anyone with whom I have ever associated. And he brought to his work the ability to translate problems into challenges. And I think of him often these days because I think if he were here, that's what he would be talking to you about, seeing if there aren't some opportunities within the really dark clouds that are over us now, so that indeed there can be, as Maya Angelou said, some rainbows there for all of us. And Jerry would be one of those who would be creating those rainbows. I questioned whether or not I'd be able to get through a statement today. So what I chose to provide to you was the statement, which was really a homily at the memorial for Jerry, in which I tried to express how much he meant to me, but also I think, how much he meant to all Oregonians. You so often use terms like public trust and public good. And Jerry trusted the public enough to go to them and seek their help in defining what is good. And so that's what I think he would be asking you to do today. It was my privilege to write the resolution. It expresses how I feel about him. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Alan. Brian and Catherine.
My name is Catherine White, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon DD Coalition, which is a coalition of providers of developmental disability services, advocates, and families and self-advocates. And Jerry was a big part of our coalition and a big part of helping us operate as a coalition. I just wanted to read a comment that Jerry made. When we gave him an award for all the work that he had done on behalf of people with developmental disabilities. And he said, as I met and talked with providers and advocates, parents, and individuals with developmental disabilities, my work transformed from a seeking of justice to a labor of love. And I think those words really say a lot about Jerry. All of us benefited both from his passion for justice and from his labor of love. He was a personal mentor, and he was a mentor to a lot of our self-advocates as well. So we are in great support of this resolution.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian DeLashmet. Very few times you'll see me come in front of a committee when I'm speechless, but when I saw Jerry toward the end, the thing that struck me about Jerry was he was more concerned about his clients than he was about himself. Very, very impressive. I met with him several times toward the end, and he kept saying, there's a lot of work to be done yet, and I'm not done, and somebody's got to pick that up. And he was searching. It was almost like a spouse looking for a new spouse for the departed spouse. He was very insistent about his work being carried on and being carried on by the right people. And that's what impressed me so much about Jerry toward the end. He was a friend, but his dedication to his clients was just priceless. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you both very much. John Blatt and Phyllis Rand. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is John Blatt. I'm the executive director of the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. We were one of Jerry's clients. I'm also the co-chair of the Housing Coalition, which is listed as the sponsor of this bill, or at the requester of this bill. And we were very happy to be the requester on this bill. That coalition is a group of advocates that you might expect Jerry to associate himself with. It was also a group that continues to this day, because I'm the co-chair, to have the business advocates, the Bankers Association, the Mortgage Lenders Association, the Realtors, the Home Builders, people who have an interest in affordable housing development also. And there was universal, of all the issues that we talked about, that we wanted to support this this session and keep our list very short. We did not want to have a long agenda coming into this session. This was one of the issues that there was universal agreement on. So, in my role as that as the co-chair, I wanted to bring that up. Then I also want to talk just for a couple of minutes. I can go on and on about Jerry, and he did probably have more defeats in his career than he had victories. But I was involved back in 1991 when we passed the Housing Trust Fund and at the same time created the Housing and Community Services Department. And Jerry brought that idea of bringing the Community Services Division out of the Department of what was then Human Services and merge it with the Housing Agency so that we could better link together the services that people in affordable housing need. And the director of the Housing Agency at that point was Ray Ramsey, and Jerry brought this idea to us and thought it was a great idea. And I think my organization has about 50 members, and since that time, that the creation of the Housing Trust Fund and the merging of the Housing and Community Services Department, we have had some significant victories. My 50 members have created 9,000 units of affordable housing. We house about 18,000 people every night in affordable, decent housing, and that is really thanks to the work of Jerry Beaverly. And I just, I know he did have more defeats than victories, but I want to point out that there are probably 18,000 people tonight who will sleep in safe, decent, affordable housing who would not have but for the work of Jerry Beaverly.
Thank you very much. Phyllis.
Good morning. It's kind of a tough time to talk, but what I want to say is that we will have some written testimony. Helen Lurie is preparing it, and it just wasn't ready. But I also need to say what an extraordinarily fine role model Jerry Beaverly was. And this is from the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, but as a person, he also showed the way for other advocates to go. And he did it in such a quiet, unassuming way. You know, he was always there. He was always staunch. You could always depend on him. He was just a tremendous person. And I personally believe that he's watching us right now.
Thank you, Phyllis. I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 7 and open a work session on HCR 7.
Mr. Chair, House Concurrent Resolution 7 be passed to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Concurrent Resolution 7 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westland.
Thank you. I know there's a lot of wet eyes in the House today, and that's certainly understandable, but this is certainly a joyous occasion as well that the credibility, integrity, and efforts of Mr. Beaverly, Jerry, has resulted in what will, you know, result in this, I'm sure, unanimous passage of this resolution out of this committee and the show of support that's in this room today. I mean, that's the tribute to Jerry. And so while I know it's quite an emotional occasion, you know, Phyllis, that he's up there smiling.
You're right.
So... Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to take a moment just to personally thank you for being willing to bring this up and move this bill forward. I'm willing to ignore your earlier show of emotion and continue to pretend that you don't have a heart.
You missed it. But Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was a staff person last session for Jackie Winters, who's now in the Senate, and I can remember seeing a piece of mail coming through from Jerry saying that he was not feeling well. He hadn't been feeling well. He was back to work. And it blew me away. I lost my father to cancer, lymphoma, when I was 10, and I know what a toll it took watching my father's last days, and just I'm amazed at the heart of somebody who cares so much to, you know, put everything aside and tell people that he's coming back to do his passion. So it's a very fitting tribute that so many of his friends are here to memorialize him.
I would say, God bless you, Jerry, but I think Ben's right. God already has. Clerk, call the roll. Excused.
Aye.
Aye. House concurrent resolution 7, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Merkley will carry, and thank you for bringing this. And I will close the work session on HCR 7. Okay. You know, committee, if I'd been smart, I would save that one for the end.
No.
It's kind of like, let's just go home.
Well, no.
Back to that heart comment, Barker.
Jerry wouldn't want us to.
No. Okay, that's true. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2190. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2191.
There you go. No, 2190.
2190.
Yeah, I was right.
You were right.
I was right for once.
My eyes are blurry. Comes to you from the Employment Department. It's granting the Employment Department explicit authority to determine questions of general policy for adoption of rules for and administer and enforce certain statutes relating to child care. This bill is a housekeeping bill. It comes to them upon recommendations of our legislative council and their Department of Justice folks.
Okay.
And
tomorrow. Were you wondering if I was ever going to get to this?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tamara Brickman, the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department, and I'll be very brief on this bill. Just a little bit of background. Up until 1993, the Employment Department existed as a division of the then Department of Human Resources, as well as the Child Care Division. A bill in the 1993 legislature transferred the Employment Division out of the Department of Human Resources and created it as its own agency, and then also at the same time transferred the Child Care Division out of DHR into the Employment Department. When the two then divisions existed under the Department of Human Resources, they had their own chapters of law. And when they transferred them over and into a separate agency, they just continued with those separate chapters of law. And Oregon Revised Statute Chapter Number 657 became the Employment Department's chapter of law, and the Child Care Division's chapter of law became ORS 657A. There was, based on a review of some child care rules, a recommendation by legislative counsel during the interim that the Employment Department clarify that the director of the Department of the Employment Department be the party responsible for adopting rules, determining questions of policy, and administering and enforcing the child care statutes, because there wasn't that tie-in when they brought the two chapters together. So that's the purpose for this amendment. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Just a clarification, when she said amendment, she was talking about the bill being an amendment to statute.
So. Correct.
Okay. There's no amendments here. So, thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2190 and open the work session on House Bill 2190. Okay. Representative Morris Anderson.
I move House Bill 2190 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morris Anderson moves House Bill 2190 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Excused.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Dalton.
Aye.
Ms. Anderson.
Aye.
Aye. Representative Monis Anderson.
A consent.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Monis Anderson moves House Bill 2190 be placed on the consent calendar. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And House Bill 2190, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Close the work session on House Bill 2190 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2349. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2349 is creating an Oregon Patient Safety Corporation as an independent public corporation to improve patient safety. It's establishing the corporation board of directors. It creates the Oregon Patient Safety Reporting Program within that corporation. It establishes a separate fund. It's appropriating money. Thus, it has a prior reference to ways and means, and it's declaring an emergency effective July 1, 2003.
Okay, Ellen Lowe, Gwen Dayton, and Roy Magnuson. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Cruz and members of the committee. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm Vice President General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I also am a participant on behalf of the Hospital Association in the Patient Safety Work Group that brings this legislation before you today, and I speak today on behalf of both the Hospital Association and the work group. I'm joined today by Ellen Lowe and Dr. Roy Magnuson from the Oregon Health Sciences University. If it pleases the committee, what we thought we would do is I would discuss the bill, what it does, hopefully don't bore you too much, but go through it section by section and give you the details of the bill, and then Ellen and Dr. Magnuson will discuss the merits of the bill further.
Okay.
First, let me explain. This bill is the product of the Patient Safety Work Group, and it's important that you know who participated in this work group because the participants really drove the end product, and the diversity of the participants drove the end product. Participants include, of course, the Hospital Association, but also the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Nurses Association, Oregon Health Sciences University, Kaiser Permanente, the Department of Human Services, the Oregon State Pharmacists Association, Regents Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Oregon, the Oregon Healthcare Association, consumers, and the Oregon Coalition of Healthcare Purchasers. So as you can see, we had representation not only from the state, but from consumers and from purchasers of healthcare, as well as providers of healthcare. This group got together to develop a patient safety reporting program in response to, or the group is reflective of, rather, the importance of patient safety and preventing adverse events. It's important not only to, of course, consumers and purchasers of healthcare, but also to providers of healthcare. We all came together with the same goal. With that goal in mind, we developed the bill that you have before you. In a nutshell, what this is a voluntary, confidential, non-punitive reporting system in which participants report serious adverse events to the Oregon Patient Safety Corporation. The corporation then analyzes the data, provides meaningful feedback to providers to assist them in their patient safety efforts, and provides aggregate information to the public describing statewide adverse event patterns. It is intended to be primarily an opportunity for learning and prevention among providers, and an opportunity for a more transparent and public patient safety system that is accountable to the public. As many of you know, hospitals and other providers are very active in the area of patient safety now. Inside the hospitals today, extensive resources and efforts are being placed towards preventing errors in hospitals. But many consumers and purchasers and others wanted a more transparent and more public system so they could see the kind of work that was done and see, hopefully, any progress that is made. And this program, hopefully, continues the efforts within hospitals and other settings, but also allows for more public input and public opportunity for understanding and education in the area of patient safety. The group proposes, because nothing is free in this world, that this program be paid for by up to 30% state funds, grants and other sources of private funding, and as necessary, fees paid by all eligible participants in the program. Eligible participants in the program include hospitals, pharmacies, long-term care facilities, renal dialysis centers, freestanding birthing centers, and ambulatory surgical centers. The reason for this list of participants is it is felt that most adverse events tend to occur in facility settings. And it's not ignoring the fact that in physicians' offices and clinics and elsewhere, there also can be adverse events. But we felt that if we wanted to have the most bang for our buck, we would focus on these facilities initially. So that's who participates in this program, and that's essentially what it is. Let me walk you through the sections at the risk of being too tedious, but I think the technical aspects of this bill are important to understand before you hear more broad brush discussions of its merits. The first section defines terms. And the most, in your testimony, I didn't list all the terms we defined, but the most significant ones. First, we define adverse event. And actually, in the amendments that were just prepared yesterday, we re-termed that serious adverse event. And what this is an objective, definable, negative consequence of patient care or the risk thereof that is unanticipated, usually preventable, and results in or presents a significant risk of patient death or serious physical injury. We felt it was important, we crafted this definition very carefully, to include existing reportable events like JCO Sentinel events that hospitals all need to report now, but expand that to include other events that are useful to analyze. But we wanted these events to be definable. We need to have a very express list of what must be reported, otherwise we will get underreporting because there will not be an understanding among facilities that report what needs to be reported. It can't just be inappropriate medication, for example. It must be something very explicit. So we crafted this definition to make that, hopefully, very clear. We also define the terms patient safety activities and patient safety data. The definition is important because it defines ultimately what information will remain confidential. And the confidential nature of this program is very important to its effective functioning and to participation by eligible participants. Section 2 of the bill establishes the Oregon Patient Safety Corporation as an independent public corporation and describes the mission of the corporation. The corporation is to establish a confidential, voluntary adverse event reporting system to identify adverse events and establish quality improvement techniques to reduce system errors contributing to adverse events and disseminate evidence-based prevention practices to improve patient outcomes. This section also specifies what ORS provisions will apply to the corporation and provides that the corporation has the option to provide PERS coverage to its employees. Pursuant to proposed amendments, we have changed that section to add that the corporation will, in fact, be subject to Chapter 183, which is the Administrative Procedures Act. That allows for formal rulemaking. It also establishes that contested case hearings and other procedures for contesting activities of the corporation. We also, this is a very small amendment, but propose that the language be clarified that PERS can be offered in lieu of another retirement program, but not necessarily in addition to. Section 3 establishes the Oregon Patient Safety Corporation Fund, and it also establishes that the corporation can accept funds from not only public but also private sources. And the corporation does hope, perhaps not in the first year, but in subsequent years, to receive a significant source of its funding from external grants. Section 4 establishes the Oregon Patient Safety Reporting Program in the corporation and describes the program. The program includes reporting by participants of serious adverse events, root cause analyses of serious adverse events, basically why it happened, action plans to prevent similar future events, and they all must submit their patient safety plans. The program will also analyze reported information to develop and disseminate information to participants to assist them in improving patient safety. It will provide technical assistance to participants as they deal with specific issues related to patient safety. The program will engage in auditing of participant reporting to ensure that the reporting is complete and credible. The corporation will oversee action plans with a similar goal to ensure that these action plans are actually, they are credible and they are implemented. The program will create incentives to improve and reward participation. Things like recognizing positive improvements in patient safety by a particular facility. It will distribute written reports to the public to describe statewide adverse event patterns. And elsewhere in the bill, it gets very specific about what these reports will include. It will also maintain a website open to the public to facilitate, as opposed to facility, which I have in my testimony, public access to reports, as well as provide a list of those who are participating. So if an entity chooses not to participate in the patient safety reporting program, that fact will be known to the public and to purchasers of health care. Section 4, sub 2 also establishes that participation in the program is voluntary. This was a significant decision point, as you can imagine, for the work group, and there was disagreement among the work group on this point. We ultimately decided, and there is consensus in the work group, that it will be voluntary. And the reason, in a nutshell, is that unless you have investment from the provider industry, that this is a positive program that will result in improvements in patient safety and benefit the public, you won't get strong participation, whether it's mandatory or not. Analysis of mandatory systems across the country have not shown necessarily any stronger participation or significantly stronger participation than you receive for voluntary programs. But, that having been said, by way of compromise, the group did agree that the program will report to the legislature every biennium, and in the 2007 biennium, it will report on whether this program should become mandatory. So the issue is open for subsequent review after we've had a few years under our belt to assess levels of participation and the credibility of the participation we've received. The section also establishes who qualifies as an eligible participant. I already listed those for you, and I won't repeat them. The section provides that patient safety data that's reported to the corporation and information developed pursuant to the auditing and the oversight functions of the oversight of participants may not be disclosed to any state agency or used for purposes of any enforcement or regulatory action. This was another significant point of discussion among the group. It was very important to providers that this not be a regulatory tool. If providers feel that if they report a serious adverse event, it will be turned over to the regulatory side of the agency and used in aid of investigation and ultimately a penalty of the facility, that there will be underreporting. The purpose of this program is not to further regulate healthcare facilities who are already extensively regulated, but rather to create an opportunity for learning and sharing and improvements in patient safety systems. So for that reason, the information is shielded from any sort of regulatory action. Pursuant to proposed amendment, though, we are clarifying that nothing is intended to prevent agencies or boards from subpoenaing the information they can already subpoena. It is not the purpose of this bill to try to shield this information, to allow a hospital, for example, to put their information in what I call the patient safety bucket and shield it from discovery from anybody else who has a legitimate need to know it for their own purposes, like investigatory, like the Board of Medical Examiners commonly subpoenas information from hospitals. We are not trying to restrict their ability to subpoena what they can already subpoena. What we're saying is they shouldn't be able to subpoena express patient safety data that is created for the purpose of reporting to the Patient Safety Corporation. Section 4 also provides that reports or other information developed or disseminated by the program may not, that's a significant typo on my part, identify any particular participant. Yeah, please, thank you. It was a long day yesterday, and I apologize. May not identify any particular participant or individual patient. The information is intended to be and must be confidential. The section also provides that participants must provide written notification in a timely manner to each patient served by the participant who is affected by a serious adverse event. This is pursuant to amendment. This wasn't in our original concept, but the work group decided that really we needed to have some accountability to the patient. They needed to know if there was a report to this corporation that concerned them. So we've included, pursuant to amendment, that the participant must notify the patient that is the subject of the adverse event in a timely manner, that the event has occurred and a report has been made. Section 5 establishes that the corporation can assess fees on participants. Fees are collected by the state agency with oversight authority over the particular participant and passed on to the corporation. Pursuant to amendment, it is changed to the bill is changed to say that a fee can be assessed on all eligible participants. This was another source of significant discussion, that how should the cost of this be spread? Should we make only participants pay, or anybody that's eligible but perhaps chooses not to participate, and we elected to include all eligible participants because this is a program that is intended to benefit all of us, intended to benefit the public. We all should share some of the cost. We also representing providers are encouraging participation. And we hope that the fact that a fee will be assessed whether you participate or not will encourage greater participation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Is it legal to do that?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even though they're not participating, you can still assess a fee.
Yes.
That would be correct. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, a clarification there. It's not like we're assessing a fee on horse tracks to do this. I mean, these are folks that are choosing not to, but are inclusive in who should be.
I appreciate that. Have you gotten any complaints from people who choose not to be a part of this but would be assessed?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, not yet. I imagine that will be an opinion that is expressed at some point.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Section 6 establishes the Oregon Patient Safety Corporation Board of Directors. It's appointed by the governor or confirmed by the Senate. It consists of 17 people, including the public health officer and 16 other consumer and provider representatives. This is a small point, but pursuant to proposed amendment, the reference to the public health officer or designee, the designee was removed. The work group thinks that this is important enough that we want the actual guy or woman to be there. The section also allows the board to appoint subcommittees and advisory groups, including very expressly a consumer advisory group. This is reflective of the desire of the work group that there be strong consumer participation and that there be transparency to consumers as to the activities of the corporation. Section 7 establishes the powers of the board. The board is to adopt policies and procedures, and pursuant to amendment, it will be rules because now we're subject to the Administrative Procedures Act. These rules or policies will include developing a list of reportable serious adverse events. This is a very important function and was a source of a lot of discussion in the work group. This list, as I indicated earlier, needs to be definable, needs to be understandable, needs to be clear to everyone what it is, and it has to be meaningful. We have to have a list that if we report all these things, we can actually develop some meaningful conclusions based on them. We talked a lot about whether to have near misses be reported, and there is absolutely no question that something that was an incorrect procedure that didn't cause any harm, you can still learn a lot from that, the fact that this occurred. But we felt that initially we would have a list that includes only events that caused death or serious physical injury and move in subsequent years to including near misses as we've gotten a handle on the, you know, just the initial goal. Get this thing started, do something, do what we can do, and then we'll look at whether near misses are something we want to include in the future. The board also needs to develop a budget, establish a process to seek grants, develop a method to determine the amount of any participant fees that are deemed necessary. We anticipate it'll be something like per bed or per discharge. Smaller groups won't pay as much as large entities. Establishing and auditing an oversight process. The process also must include certification from the public health officer on the completeness, the credibility, and the acceptability of participant reports, root cause analysis in section, and action plans. We felt it was very important that while we don't want this to be a regulatory program, participants need to be accountable. So we have to have some kind of oversight that they are participating in good faith and doing what they are charged to do. So that hopefully meets that function.
Can I back you up just a minute?
Sure.
And on determining the fees, and you're talking about a per bed or per discharge, and clearly there's a difference in affordability, for example, with A and B and DRG, and so those sort of factors will be taken into account, I'm assuming.
Absolutely. They need to be.
Okay.
Because many of the participants are much smaller. Ambulatory surgical centers, for example, are much smaller, and we need to have an equitable method to assess fees.
Okay.
The board also establishes the criteria for terminating a participant from the program. This is another attempt to make sure that participants are, in fact, accountable, that they will be terminated from the program if they do not participate in good faith. One of the other reasons they'll be terminated is if they don't notify the patient as they're required to. And the fact that somebody has been terminated from the program will be likely included on the website and made available to consumers and to purchasers as they make their health care choices. The section also reiterates the confidential, non-punitive nature of the program, providing that the board can't use or disclose patient safety data for purposes of any enforcement or regulatory action in relationship to a participant, and the board must maintain the confidentiality of any identifiable information, meaning identifies a participant.
Senator Palmieri.
Thank you. Gwen, I'm going to go back.
Sure.
Mine goes a little bit slower than the way you speak. I'm still back on termination.
Yes.
So will there be any forum for someone who's been terminated to appeal that?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tamai, it's a good question. Yes, there should be. That's something the board certainly can address when they're establishing their criteria. Since we're subject to Chapter 183, which does allow contested case hearings, I imagine that is how that, that grievance will be resolved. Yeah.
Representative Morris Anderson.
But how will that correlate with the contracts, collective bargaining contracts? Aren't there grievance processes through the unions in the...
Chair Cruz, Representative Mona Sanderson, there are others, I'm sure, who are far more knowledgeable in this area than I am, but my impression, I think, and I hope that others will correct if my answer is not a correct answer to your question, is that participants will not be subject to any level of collective bargaining. They are not in any manner part of a union amongst themselves. There very likely will be a memorandum of understanding between the participant and the program that establishes the requirements for their participation, such as you must participate for at least 1 year, such as you must, you know, credibly and fully report and things like that. I think that will dictate the discussion about whether somebody has been improperly terminated. I'm not certain that it's going to be, would be subject to any kind of a collective bargaining or other contractual restriction.
Just follow. So, yeah, I'm not, I guess I need to know what a serious adverse event would be, but I was just concerned about employees who we already have a grievance process through our hospitals, et cetera, and how this would correlate. This would be addressing something different.
Yes, Chair Cruz, Representative Mona Sanderson, a better answer to your question is that when we talk about a participant being removed from the program, we're talking about the hospital or the surgical center or the actual entity rather than an individual physician or nurse or other. Yeah. Section 7 provides that the corporation must report to the legislature no later than September 30th of every biennium regarding the progress of the program. And as I indicated before, very specifically, the program needs to report on whether or not it is the recommendation of the program that the, it become mandatory, and that will occur in the year 2007. Section 8 establishes budget preparation requirements and requires auditing, public auditing of the accounts and financial affairs of the corporation. Section 9 requires the corporation to submit its budget to the Legislative Assembly February 1 of every odd number year for review and approval. And it also provides that the state may be obligated for up to 30% of the cost of administering the program. This was a point of discussion as well, as you can imagine. And it was felt by the work group that because this program is meant, of course, to benefit participants in improving their own patient safety activities, but also to benefit the public. Frankly, all the participants in this program engage in patient safety activities every day. The reason we have this program is to assist in those efforts, but also to benefit the public and purchasers of healthcare. Give them a more transparent system so they can understand the activities and see the activities that are being done. It has a societal benefit in addition to a benefit to providers, and because of that, we felt there needed to be a state commitment. But it says up to 30%. That commitment, understanding our current situation, could be zero. We didn't set a floor. We are hopeful that if there are not funds available, actual funds available for this, the state's contribution may well take the form of in-kind contribution of office space, computers, or other facilities available to it. So it's meant to be flexible, but also to reflect the commitment that the state has to this process and should have to this process.
Can I stop a minute, please?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, so will this go to the Ways and Means?
Yes.
It has a referral.
Okay.
Section 10 provides for appointment of executive director of the corporation. 11 is a significant section, and I won't belabor it, but it establishes the confidentiality of patient safety data and activities. But hopefully, if we had done our job right, it maintains the ability, the current ability, to of lawyers and agencies and others who seek information to get all the information they currently get. They'll still be able to get medical records, still be able to get anything they currently have been able to get. Facilities that participate in this will not be able to shield information from discovery by calling it patient safety data. What is shielded from discovery is only that information and data that is prepared for purposes of reporting to the corporation. It was very important to the work group that we do this right and not impinge upon any existing ability to access information that is currently available. So, with that summary, Sections 1 and 2 establish that patient safety data and reports obtained by a patient safety data reporting program are confidential and privileged and not admissible in evidence in any civil proceeding. Notice that we didn't say, we didn't refer to the Oregon Patient Safety Program specifically. We made it broader. The reason we did that is because there are other efforts underway nationally to encourage hospital and other reporting. For example, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services are establishing a voluntary reporting program for hospitals. Hospitals report to the federal government certain information, and that will be aggregated, and very similar functions to this will be performed. Hospitals want to participate in this, but they can't right now if they want the information to be confidential. Right now, if they internal to the hospital, it's very confidential. But once you report out, it's not. So I was directed by my board to make sure that this bill allows them to report not only to the Patient Safety Reporting Program in Oregon, but to any other legitimate patient safety reporting programs that are intended to benefit patient safety in the facilities and for consumers broadly. So that's why it's written that way. Section 3 or subsection 3 clarifies that the privilege established in the bill does not apply to records of a patient's medical diagnosis and treatment and to records of a participant created in the ordinary course of business. That's reflective of my prior comments. Patient safety data that's contained in business records of a participant shall be maintained confidential. Subsection 5 establishes that a person serving on the corporation board or committee or a person communicating information or doing work for the corporation isn't subject to an action for civil damages for affirmative actions taken or statements made in good faith. Amendments to that provision add that they also won't be held liable for acts of omission. Somebody fails to do something that also will not be something for which they could be subject to civil damages. Subsection 6 provides that no participant, which in this context includes not only the entity itself, but employees, volunteers, medical staff, other individuals, can be examined in a civil proceeding as to whether any communication has been made with another participant or with the program regarding patient safety data or activities, reports, etc., provided the communication was made with the intent of making disclosure or preparing a report to be submitted to the corporation. The idea is you don't want somebody to go and depose a physician and say, isn't it true that you reported this information to the Patient Safety Corporation because this was in fact an adverse event. We don't want this to be used as a tool in litigation. It's not meant for that purpose. Subsection 7 provides that clarifies that nothing in the bill is intended to limit or diminish existing obligations of participants to report as required by law, provide information to state or federal agencies for purposes of licensure or certification, or comply with state and federal laws relating to quality assurance, personnel management, and infection control requirements. This is an important section that's been subject of a lot of attention, not only by the work group, but by others, some of whom are probably in this room, that wanting to make sure that they can still get the information they currently get and need to get to perform their own functions, state agencies and boards predominantly. And it's our intention that they get all that. So hopefully we've done our job right and they will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to subsection 6, have you gotten a DA's opinion on that regarding whether any of the information could not be, used in court? Is that the intent of what this piece says? I wasn't sure. Any civil proceedings? I mean, what if?
Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, we did have the Health Division's Attorney General look at this bill. They didn't express a formal opinion on that particular provision. I do not believe, however, that that particular provision preventing somebody from being examined in a deposition is typically it or in court would pose a legal problem. If there are those who think it does, we're certainly happy to entertain that opinion.
But this isn't saying... This isn't saying, well, it says provides that no participant may not be examined in any civil, that's a double negative.
Yeah, sorry.
may not be examined in any civil proceeding. I'm trying to think of the situation, but I can't right now. I was just thinking that something may be so severe that it really needed to go to court. This is saying that you can't.
Let me clarify. It is not saying that a physician, for example, could not be questioned in court about a bad outcome and ultimately an adverse event involving his patient or another patient. It is saying that they cannot be examined as to whether or not they reported an event to the corporation and what they reported to the corporation. Nothing prevents that physician, for example, from being examined as to all of what happened in the same way that they could be examined now. Subsection 8 indicates that reporting to the corporation doesn't waive any privilege or protection established in the Act or otherwise in Oregon law, which is important because hospitals have peer review protections for much of their internal quality assurance work, and we did not want this external reporting to in any way pierce that peer review veil and make that information subject to discovery. Section 12 is the appropriation section. 13 is a sunset provision. We decided to have this subject to repeal in 2010. The point is not that we don't think this will function and easily repealed in 2010, but rather we felt that would be a good time to review the program, determine whether it's been effective, make changes that need to be made, and just do a full assessment of the program. And then, of course, Section 14 is the emergency clause. Can I answer any questions after giving you the quick and dirty version?
The only question I have is that because the dash twos are relatively warm still, are you comfortable with them? I mean, have you had a chance to really do your lawyer stuff?
Chair Cruz, yes. I've had a chance to read them. I got them yesterday afternoon.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I appear today to support HB 2349 with the amendments creating the Public Safety Corporation. And if you look at the requesters of the bill, you'll see all these very important organizations, and then you'll see one name of an individual. And that's...
I noticed that right away.
So my participation really was as a consumer representative. So in some ways, I came without portfolio, but in some ways, I probably came with thousands of folks who I tried to represent. I saw my primary role really to raise some of the concerns that many health service consumers hold as they seek treatment. For consumer confidence in the healthcare system is often as fragile as the health system itself. So as I sought remedies that would support healthcare system improvements that would result in quality outcomes for patients, what I really discovered in this group was that I was not alone, because all of the groups who participated and the representatives that they sent shared my quest for a process and a culture of patient safety that would work for the patients and the institutions charged with serving them. And I ought to interject that at the same time that this was going on, some of us were involved in the professional liability work group, the malpractice. And as I participated in that as a consumer, it became so obvious to me that it was going to take a long time to really find some areas of common ground among the trial bar and among the providers and the insurance industry. But, you know, there was one area where we all seemed to express some concern and some commitment, and that was to do something about making sure that there were better outcomes so that maybe some of those other issues would be less in the future than they were now. I really do believe that the proposal that we have presented to you will contribute to a safer environment for health service consumers, because it does respect the confidentiality issues, both because of ethics and because of law. And I believe the corporation will facilitate the sharing of information by creating what Gwen has described, and that really is a learning environment. This should lead to positive changes in behavior by systems and the people who staff them. And the reporting mechanism should provide a visibility to our systems that will legitimately build trust within the public and among healthcare practitioners. I believe the disclosure protections will assure timely sharing, and I also feel the structure places no additional barriers for patient access to their patient record and for redress. I support the public corporation form of governance, which is in the bill, the proposed composition of the board of directors, and the opportunity for continuing feedback from consumers by the Consumer Advisory Committee. And also, I think the door is open there for healthcare practitioners also to give technical advice to the board of directors as they proceed with their work. I believe patient safety is an issue of statewide concern, so I do hope there will be some state commitment to making sure this happens, because then I believe there really will be accountability for all Oregonians. And this is an issue that we need to address now. Thanks.
Thank you. Roy.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Roy Magnuson. I'm a practicing emergency physician, and for the past several years have been the medical director of the Oregon Health Sciences University Hospital and Clinics. In that role, quality is a big part of my day and my job, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2349 as a member of the task force in asking your help to help us advance this effort. I'd like to give just a little bit of background with respect to what's happening now and why I think this bill could really add a lot to what's happening. In 1999, the Institute of Medicine released a report called To Err Is Human. In that report, they acknowledged that perhaps as many as somewhere between 50,000 and 100,000 preventable deaths are occurring each year in hospitals across the country. And while many argue about the actual number, I think there's general consensus that it's too many, and that something needs to improve. Their follow-up report a couple of years ago, Closing the Quality Chasm, there were several recommendations. The first was to define patient care processes as high quality if they're patient-centered, safe, timely, efficient, effective, and equitable. And they went on to suggest that most errors are not due to individual errors or personal issues with personnel issues, that most errors occur because the system designed to provide that care was flawed in some way, shape, or form. And they go on to recommend that healthcare professionals share information regarding common causes of medical errors and use that information to redesign processes to be safer and more efficient, more effective. Now, from a physician's point of view, if I can put that head on for just a second, we have a longstanding responsibility to our patients to advocate for them as individuals, and a longstanding responsibility to the public to provide standard of care medicine and medical decision making. But taking the Institute of Medicine's findings to heart, the great deal of what happens to my patients is less to do with my medical decision-making than the system's design that provide the care that I ask to be provided. And so to be truly responsible to my patients, I need to be actively involved in the improvement of those processes. And this is one venue for us to do that. Physicians need a framework within which to contribute to this effort. And in order to gauge physicians and other practitioners in healthcare in a really enthusiastic way, it needs to be a positive, constructive, and innovative approach. Much can and already is being done at the institutional level. In my institution, I will use as an example, but this is happening in many places. At OHSU, we've adopted the Institute of Medicine definition and begun measuring our ability to deliver care in a consistent and safe way. We're comparing our results to other organizations that are similar to us across the country. We're reorganizing and have reorganized our committee structure within our professional staff to target specific quality and safety issues. An example is our safety committee, which is reviewing best practices and national recommendations coming from the Institute of Medicine, looking at our own performance and making recommendations on how we can improve that internally. And one critical part of this is to encourage incident reporting and critical incident reporting immediately to my office within the health system so that we can dissect those through the root cause analysis and identify what happened and what do we need to correct to make sure it doesn't happen again. Well, even though all this is in place, it is our belief that House Bill 2349 can really add to this effort. And the reasons are several. First of all, it would allow statewide standardization of data collection methods and definitions. Currently, each hospital is using its own. Secondly, the data sharing among multiple facilities will allow us to identify trends and issues much earlier. It will, will be able to avoid having to experience an adverse outcome in each hospital before it can be addressed by every hospital. The goal is to develop expertise within the state capable of identifying best practices and to have a single group reviewing the results of root cause analysis for multiple organizations, thus allowing the sharing of solutions across health systems. The OPSC would allow the establishment of a knowledge base for developing evidence-based regulations for licensure and health systems and other organizations in the future by collecting information about what the true safety issues are. Over time, these best practices could be incorporated into regulatory standards for hospitals, surgical centers, and other providers in a logical and relevant fashion based on actual information gathered here in Oregon. The two most important reasons that I feel this is should be supported are these next two. And as the creation of this patient safety corporation will be a very important first step in establishing the culture that Ellen mentions, where issues are quickly reported and assessed with an emphasis on systems improvement rather than institutional or individual blame, thus allowing rapid sharing of hard-learned lessons among competitors towards the overall goal of improving care for Oregonians everywhere. Last and not least is the concept that it provides a format that encourages the reporting of individual cases by hospital under protection from discovery in order to allow aggregate information regarding the overall performance of Oregon's health system to be provided to the public. It's our hope that this will lead to a higher level of public confidence in our healthcare system and better consumer understanding of the challenges that health system is facing today. The OPSC annual reports will provide a format for open debate regarding safety issues and a framework within which to set our priorities and goals and elevate safety standards in health care, thus improving care and increasing public trust in our health care delivery system. For these reasons, OHSU strongly supports House Bill 2349, and we look forward to actively participating in this process.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you all very much. Grant and June Ann. Jane Ann. It could be an A, could be a U. We'll find out in a minute. Good morning.
Chairman Cruz, members of the committee, my name is June Ann Cole, and I am a nurse practice specialist for the Oregon Nurse Association. And I am, as a representative of the Oregon Nurse Association, as a registered nurse, and as a member of the committee that helped to draft this legislation, I would like to testify in support of this bill, of the Oregon Patient Safety Corporation. I've been in active nursing practice for about 20 years. My practice has included intensive care, clinics, and occupational medicine. And like most nurses, I have seen medical errors that have compromised the patient safety and many instances of situations where had the nurses not or medical staff not reacted appropriately, it could have compromised patient safety. And like many consumers, I've had a serious medical error impact my own family. While there are instances in which individuals are truly at fault when medical errors occur, we have ways to deal with those. What we don't have is a mechanism to deal with the system's problems that are the root cause of a large percentage of the medical errors. I know, as a participant of this committee, that it was not the committee's, that it has been the committee's intent throughout that nothing in this bill would interfere with or change the responsibility of the regulatory boards. Oregon Nurse Association believes that the board, as constructed in the legislation, may be lacking in some expertise, but we expect that the board would choose to address these deficiencies with advisory committees that consist of clinical practice nurses, lab technicians, x-ray technicians, and nuclear medicine technicians. I would like to personally express my appreciation for having the opportunity to serve on this committee. I found that all of the members were dedicated to creating a culture of patient safety. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill.
Thank you very much. Grant.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services. And I will try to keep this brief because you've already heard, I think, some outstanding testimony this morning. Dr. Magnuson raised the issue of the Institute of Medicine reports and what they came up with in the way of recommendations. And we at the department took those recommendations to heart and consequently last fall convened a work group that you've heard about already today. This was a diverse work group. And I would like to publicly thank them for the hours and hours of hard and dedication, the hard work and dedication that they put into to crafting this bill, which the department is very supportive of. The bottom line is we are trying to create a culture of patient safety with this bill. The first step, or one of the first steps, is to create the Oregon Public Safety Corporation. You've heard about that already, and the board of directors that would represent a diverse number of perspectives on that board. The key function of the corporation, at least in its early work, would be to develop this reporting system, and the point of that would be to gain more information on medical errors so the corporation can then offer back to participating facilities in a non-punitive way technical assistance and feedback to help improve practices. And we would also have periodic reporting to the public and the healthcare community as well. There are a number of issues that I would like to highlight very, very briefly. The question of voluntary versus mandatory participation in these activities was discussed for many hours at the work group level. And what they decided was that they did not want to have a mandatory system. They wanted it to be voluntary, but they did want to have strong incentives for participation. And that is where the mandatory fees issue came about, so that there's voluntary participation with the incentive of mandatory fees to get people to participate. And in response to Representative Tomei's earlier question about whether or not some facilities are going to object to this, and it's possible that some individual facilities may object. We have not heard that yet, but they may. But one thing that was impressive to me as we went along in this process, I thought we were going to start out actually with fewer numbers of facilities, kinds of facilities participating, and as we discussed this further, associations came forward and said, no, this is really important work, we want to be included. So although there may be some individual facilities that object to this, the associations that represent those facilities, by and large, have been very supportive of this idea, including the mandatory fee piece. Another, I think, important piece is the funding piece, and I think it is a real commitment from the healthcare system itself that they are willing to fund this corporation and their activities with fees if that's needed. We at the state level will continue to provide the in-kind of support that we've already been providing in the creation of the work group and the staff support that we've provided will continue in the developmental and implementation phases of the corporation as well. We, though, cannot go beyond that and create impacts on the general fund portion of the governor's balanced budget beyond that at this time. In addition to our in-kind support and fees, we will be looking for federal matching dollars, and we will also aggressively be pursuing grants as well. And I think that the passage of this bill would be a huge leverage piece for us in the obtaining of those grants. As Ellen Lowe mentioned, there is an important aspect of this, that the corporation and our activities have some real public credibility, and that was the point for including the state public health officer as a member of the board of directors and making sure that office is responsible for checking on the completeness and credibility of reports, and also that those reports don't just sit on a shelf, but there's actually root cause analysis being done at the facilities themselves, and that is leading to corrective actions so that we're actually improving patient safety. You've also already heard a number of people talk about the barriers to good reporting right now, and the way the system is currently set up with a regulatory and punitive approach to reporting of medical errors, there really is a disincentive to report. And so the whole idea here is to try to encourage incentives, and the way we feel can best do that is to make sure that the information that is being provided is confidential and will not be disclosed. On the other hand, people certainly recognize that there are some individual practitioners who practice negligently. There are facilities that do not meet standards. And there are agencies that have a mission to make sure that those things don't happen or that they're corrected when they do. And there's absolutely nothing in this bill that we are attempting to preempt the mandatory reporting, licensing or the pursuit of any lawful investigation. And I think that we still have some work to do on this in the way of crafting amendments to the bill to make sure that all of the licensing boards and regulatory agencies are comfortable that we're not taking any authority or responsibilities away from them. I'm convinced after talking with a number of them that we can do that, but I still think that we have some work to do in the way of amendments. As also has been stated, we recognize that patients, when they have been harmed, when they are receiving health care services, do have the right to seek legal remedies. And again, there's nothing in this bill that is trying to prevent any patient or their legal representative from getting the information that they currently have access to in the way of patient records and other information at the hospitals. Again, as was mentioned, we are wanting to have public involvement in the corporation and their activities. Consumers will be represented on the board as well as purchasing groups. There will be periodic reports, and one of the committees is subcommittees of the corporation will be a committee dealing with consumer issues. And then the final thing that I would like to say is that we have been working with the governor's office on this bill, and conceptually they are in support of the bill. They do want to have additional time to review the amendments that are coming forward. They have made it clear that we need to make sure that there are no additional general fund impacts from the activities that are spelled out in the bill. And finally, they would want to make sure that we have all of the involved parties on board with this before they could give their full support. And with that, I'd close and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Well, just a second. Can you show me where in the Dash 2s people are assuming that this corporation is usurping any authority? Because I don't see it. And clearly, I want to give the agencies a chance to review the legislation, but by the same token, unless there's something very glaring here, I will wait, but I'm not going to wait long to move this. I don't think other amendments are necessary. But
and Mr. Chair, we attempted, or the work group attempted when we were drafting the bill, to try to make sure that it was clear,
right,
that there wasn't any usurping of authority or impairment of people, licensing boards and agents, regulatory agencies, to do their work. We have had some discussions, though, particularly with the Board of Medical Examiners and Kathleen Haley, and also with senior and people with disabilities who regulate nursing homes, that they do want to see some additional clarifying language just to make sure those issues are covered. I know Kathleen Haley is up to present next, and Tina Kitchen from Senior and People with Disabilities is in the room, too, if you'd like to hear from her.
I guess my point, Grant, is if we got tweaks, let's do them now, because I want to move this. I mean, obviously not today. I mean, if the governor wants a little more time, I'm more than happy to give him a little more time, but not much. So.
And Chair Cruz, I appreciate that.
Okay.
Both a little more time and not much more time.
Okay. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I hope it could be answered quickly. The previous presenter mentioned this, and also in your written testimony, you say patient safety research indicates that most errors are a result of systems issues. However, the current assumption is that errors occur primarily due to poor practice by individual health care providers. And I think that's certainly true in both cases. Can you give us a quick example of a system failure as opposed to an individual failure?
Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, I think one example we could use is what recently happened at Duke University. Here was a case where a person received the wrong blood type in the tissues that they received. My guess is that there's going to be a number of lawsuits there, both on the institution and on the provider who did not check that to say who is to blame here for not doing this. The way the corporation would look at that issue is to take a look at what was in place in the way of checks and double checks, in the way of the system for processing the time that the person had their blood typing done till the time they got the tissue found and the tissues then into the patient. And it was those systems errors where people did not check or checked and failed to make the right call or failed to inform somebody of the fact that there was a problem. Those are the kind of systems issues that we would want to be remedy.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Kathleen? You can point out the spot I'm missing here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the executive director for the Board of Medical Examiners. I just got the Dash 2 amendments about 4 minutes ago. And as you know, the board has the supervision responsibilities over the practice of medicine, and through its licensing, investigative, and disciplinary responsibilities, attempts to protect Oregon's citizens. And we are not here to rain on the parade of the committee or the desire to set up this corporation. Anything that's going to increase learning and eliminate mistakes is something that we would applaud. I just had some concern because, frankly, there are times that we have difficulties now getting our subpoenas honored by hospitals for patient records. And so I think there does need to be a little more work to clarify that we don't want the records of this corporation, but we want to have continued access to patient records from hospitals and the other facilities covered by this bill. And the other point for clarification is that it's my understanding that it would be the facility participants that would be processing the fees and not the participants that may include physicians and other healthcare workers. And I'm happy to answer any questions, and I want to continue to work with Dr. Higginson and Ms. Dayton. We have been working closely on trying to get these amendments together. Thank you.
Okay. Gwen? You coming too, Scott?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I think I'm the bodyguard.
For whom?
It's kind of scary.
I would pick somebody else. Because sometimes he is one himself. But
Barney's available.
Barney is available, yeah. I guess my question, can you address Kathleen's concern, and now this is to the Dash 2 or to the
No, that was
bill.
From the original bill.
Okay, so this is, okay, I mean.
Because I just got the Dash 2 at 10:25.
So, I mean, clearly we don't want to usurp the BME's authority. So do we need something here?
Chair Cruz, no, we don't. I would refer to the. Make my amendments back. We did address that issue. Kathleen and I have spoken and prior to this hearing, and she proposed some language, and we took that language, and it finds itself in paragraph B, on page 6, top of page 6 of the amended version of the bill, and it basically says. And I think this does the job, and if it doesn't, Kathleen and I do not disagree in our goal, so it's merely a matter of language. It says, except as provided in paragraph A of the subsection, which refers to patient safety data not being subject to subpoena,
right.
The subsection cannot be construed or should not be construed to limit the investigation and subpoena powers of a state agency, which would include the Board of Medical Examiners, for purposes of any enforcement or regulatory action in relation to a participant. My concern with the amendment that was submitted is this actually gives them broad subpoena power than they currently have. This says that nothing in the section prohibits any state board or commission, etc., from exercising powers of subpoena and investigation regarding patient or other records. Well, they currently don't have the ability to go after, for example, peer review data. And this section would allow them to do that. I don't think they want to. I don't think that's their point. But this is too broad. I think this does the job for them.
Okay. Comment. I mean, I know it's a
quick
read.
Well, like I said, I got it 5 minutes ago. I'd like to have a little time to look at it, because there was another section in the bill that I had some concerns about, and maybe that same language could be plugged in there.
Okay.
So I would just like an opportunity to review it.
Okay. What I'm going to do is we're going to put this on Friday's schedule, bring it back just to take a look at the twos to see if everybody's... When I talk about short window, I'm talking short windows, so... Give everybody a chance to look at the twos, make sure all concerns are addressed. If we have any other changes we need, bring them Friday or we're moving the bill.
Okay.
Is that a committee understand that? So. I mean, does that fit within everybody's time frame?
That's fine.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And, Mr. You clarified, I just wanted to define this window that you've opened and will rapidly shut.
Yeah, I'm assuming that 2 days is within the governor's look-at window also. We can make that assumption. Okay. Well, thank you all very much.
Yep.
And we also have, for the record, written testimony from Tom Holt, Oregon State Pharmacists Association. So, good presentation. Thank you all. This is an important piece of legislation. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2349. And what? Oh, yeah, it's right here. Okay, and we are adjourned. I was thinking you're